Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guest. And this evening our guest is Charles Kupis, and we're going to be talking about his book, America's Financial Reckoning Day, How You Can Survive America's Monetary and Political Decline in the 21st Century. The foreword is written by our good friend Patrick Wood. I'd never talked to Mr. Kupis until recently. He is a financial advisor, and he's a licensed securities precious metals broker with a national firm. But he's written a fascinating book. We had him as a guest, I think it was last Friday, on the second hour of our program. But I asked him to come back today, this evening, because there's so much more in his book that you need to know about. You need to know about some of the laws that are in place that date back to 1933, where we have the ability to declare a virtual dictatorship, a military dictatorship in America under the laws that were passed under FDR that have been renewed every year, 2 years by our Congress, so-called Enabling Act. Why would these things be in place? Because there are people who have a different vision of America, who really do not believe in our freedom, do not believe in our Constitution, and of course, what are presently using the military and financial power of the United States to bring about a one-world government, a one-world religion, and a one-world ruler. Well, for that as a background, Charles, thank you very much for being with us again.
Very nice to be with you again.
All right, I'm going to let you pick up the story. Where would you like to pick it up?
Well, I guess let me just say that everything we talked about last Friday, of course, it's on your website, but it's all in my book, and everything I share with folks on the air is in my book. So people can either take notes or they can go to my website, which is chuckkupis.com. That's C-O-P-P-E-S.com. And basically, I would probably just restate that I've written this book, about 500 days of research, based on my acknowledgement, and I think a lot of American people, that we're facing some critical fiscal challenges, what I call structural imbalances or economic distortions. And the mere frustration, as you might know over the years, Dr. Stan, of trying to share these things with people, does compel one to put things in writing or write a book. And that's what I've done. It's about 300 pages or so. And it's written from a Christian perspective as well, but it's probably fitting today. What did Benjamin Franklin say? The only thing certain in this life was death and taxes, right?
Right.
So here we are on tax day. By the way, I don't think a lot of people, the post office was nearly empty today, and I asked them, I said, I was shipping out my books, and they said, they thought it was yesterday. So, but here it is, and taxes, death and taxes. Actually, taxes are temporary, and if you know the Lord, you can beat death as well. And we shared quite a bit by way of review, I guess, on the Federal Reserve, the monetary system, what led to central banking and that sort of thing in the U.S., and our heroes like Andrew Jackson and so on, who shamefully are being put on our $20 bills, and that the Fed is involved in monetary inflation. And I guess people are not real clear on that, because the economists like to talk about price inflation, and that's distorting the picture, because it's cause and effect. And so that's some of the review that we did on the Fed. And
I think the important thing for people to understand is certainly rising prices do not create inflation. They reflect inflation. Inflation is increasing the money supply, and that's just what the Fed is doing.
That's the result, exactly.
Go right ahead.
And so the government spending has been encouraged through a central bank, which can do this on the federal level, taxes. The government can either tax or it can borrow or it can print the money. And it always has preferred the latter because it's less understood. As John Maynard Keynes said, not one man in a million can really understand monetary inflation or how they do this. And I might put a plug in, Dr. Stan, for the Foundation Association for Education, for Monetary Education. I think it's called FAME.org, F-A-M-E.org, and they have a pretty good understanding of these issues. But tonight I thought we might pick up with taxes and the welfare state and basically how the Fed has contributed to the welfare state in the U.S. since we're all funding that. And today's a good day to talk about how we support that.
All right, Ryan and Christian, the thing is that, you know, there's no way the government can provide everything that people want because people always want more. I mean, who wouldn't like to get free medical care? Who wouldn't like to get a government pension? Who wouldn't like to have the government provide for our health and our welfare? I mean, who wouldn't like a free lunch? And, of course, this has been tried repeatedly down through the ages, and it has always failed. And it's failing here in the United States when Lyndon Johnson agreed to go put in the Medicare program in the 1965. He was told it would cost no more than $9 billion a year by 1990. Well, he said, gee, we can probably afford that, you know. Well, of course, by 1990, it was costing $90 billion a year. And now it's up $200 to $300 billion a year. And there's no way that it could be funded.
Well, as Gary Allen says, whatever you subsidize, you get more of, whether it's, farm programs, unwed mothers, food stamps, you know, whatever the government's going to subsidize, you'll get more of. H.L. Mencken was a social critic, and he said that the government is a broker in pillage, and every election is sort of an advance auction on the sale of stolen goods. And that's a theme that ought to ring pretty true today on tax day as well.
Yeah, I think
redistribution of the wealth.
Right. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Chuck Kopas. We're going to be talking about his book of America's Financial Day of Reckoning. And what people must understand is that day is getting very close. Why would anybody want to destroy the value of our currency and impoverish our people? Do you know a better way to justify the implementation of a dictatorship in America? And they know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want you to find out. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chuck Kopas. His book, America's Financial Day of Reckoning. Pick up the story there, Chuck.
Okay. Basically, from, and I think it's good to know, since World War II, since 19, and during that period, 1940 to 45, about 60% of the revenue the U.S. needed was borrowed through the Fed, monetized through the Fed. And unemployment during that same period went from 16% down to 1%. So the war effort really rescued. It wasn't FDR's New Deal. It was actually the war, as people know historically, kind of took us out of the Great Depression. But his New Deal expanded the government, socialism and welfare statism prior to World War II. And that was through the help of the economic theories of John Maynard Keynes, who was circulating his ideas around Europe as well as in the 1930s and so on. In 1937, Social Security was established, and in 1939, they added survivor's insurance. In 1956, the disability insurance, and now we know it as old age, survival and disability insurance. And it's not insurance, by the way. That's just another fraud, like the FDIC, the deposit insurance. That's not insurance. It's just a scheme. And it's a Ponzi scheme. It's really Marxism. It's just taking from one group and giving to another. In fact, I think that's what Voltaire said. The art of government, he said, consists of taking as much money as possible from one class of citizens to give to the other. And that's the old tried and true method of big government.
That's what that old saying, he who borrows from Peter to pay Paul can always count on Paul's vote.
Yeah, that's right. So 1958 might be worth knowing that ARF was founded, Association for the Retirement of Retired People. They now have 50 or 40 million members, and they're even attracting people down to 55. And incidentally, I turned 55 on our next program on Friday. I'm not going to join, though. I don't like socialism. In 1965, Medicare was adopted, Medicaid, and added was added as well. And then, of course, food stamps were added through Hubert Humphrey. Kennedy then came along with the New Frontier, and then we have Johnson's Great Society. And Charles Murray wrote a great book, Losing Ground, I think it's about 25 years ago, during the Reagan years. And Losing Ground, how the welfare system is failing us. He said it's increased 20-fold from 1950 to 1980. And, of course, Nixon helped that through the war years. The U.S. debt is now, the fiscal, last fiscal figures we had was about $8.2 trillion. In my book, I use a chart because it's basically been upped just last month, 2 months ago. They upped it to about $9 trillion. And I know these are large figures. It might be interesting to know that a trillion seconds would take 30,000 years. That's how incomprehensible these figures are. And I think people shrug it off and think, well, you know, we'll always be around, we'll always pay our bills. Tell you what, the first $1 trillion occurred in 1980, Reagan's first term. The second trillion hit in 1984. Third trillion was in 1990. Fourth trillion in 1993. Fifth trillion in 1996. 1999, we came up to $6 trillion. And since George Bush, the conservative party's in, we have now have a $3 trillion more. And you can see the exponential rise in this. The based on the old figures fiscal year 2006, the $8.2 trillion national debt, that's called public debt, by the way. That's something that that's what we call mortgaging the future. That's your kids. We owe this publicly. They're signing on for this. And 58% of that, almost $5 trillion, is publicly held. That is publicly held securities and debt and so on. It's interesting to know that 42% of that, and people need to know this, $3.5 trillion, is called intergovernmental holdings. And this is Al Gore's reference to the lockbox on the trust funds, Social Security Trust Fund, what do we got, Medicare Trust Fund, and the Civil Service Retirement. That's for government employees, military. These are the trust funds, and I'll tell you what, they are empty. They're empty because they're considered an asset and a liability. And what they place in there is general government obligation bonds. They're not even really negotiable. Those are just IOUs, and they say that future generations are going to pay that. It's good to know also that in the scheme of things, the publicly held debt by our foreigners, it's about 40%. That's pretty big exposure offshore. And then the Fed has about 17% and so on. China holds about $300 billion in these figures. Securities. Japan holds about $800 billion, and the United Kingdom is third, about $200 billion, and the balance is around the world. But today on tax day, April 17th here, it's important to know, as we talked about the Federal Reserve, creation of the Federal Reserve last week, in 1913, February 16th of 1913, they passed the 16th Amendment, questionably, which was the direct tax on income. And later in that same year, they needed that first. It's the same group that sponsored this. And that same year, later in December, they passed the Federal Reserve Act. And the reason this was important, you got to understand, the Fed is able to conceal its government spending or monetary inflation through taxation. And I'll explain that. In 1909, Nelson Eldridge he conspired with President Taft. He proposed a direct tax on income. And It didn't pass in that year, but finally through in 1913, they finally passed. And they passed it as soak the rich legislation, soak the rich. So it really played well to the masses, you know, redistribution of the wealth. And basically, the government Constitution says, in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, says that Congress can lay taxes, but the duties and excises must be uniform, must be on the consensus, on the census, rather. There never was an implication of direct taxes. The only direct taxes within Section 9.4 of the Constitution, no poll tax or direct tax unless it is uniform and only for national emergencies. So, in other words, there had to be a provision, and this was for retiring war debts, which they did in 1798, 1813, 1815, and then the Civil War was longer, 1861, about 1870. But those debts were retired. There was a modest tax. I understand it was about 1 or 2%. So it wasn't hardly any. We have always been funded, and our founding fathers intended there to be indirect taxation. In other words, we were to fund the government. We have to ask ourselves, what did we do? before 1913? What did we do without the Internal Revenue Service? How did we pay our bills? We kept government small because we did it through excise, mostly through tariffs, and indirect taxation, which is point of sale and that sort of thing. It was known.
Chuck, I really think they needed the income tax, which was supposedly only for the rich, but of course, as we find out, it's really to wipe out the middle class, because the rich always have means of getting around paying their taxes. But, you know, basically, if they were going to have a series of wars, you have to have a lot of money to be able to have a massive military establishment. And that was what they really needed, that and, of course, the money, so that they could really buy the support of the people, and they buy the support of the people with their own money. That's the incredible thing, taking from one group to give to another. And then, of course, we give a lot of money to the agriculturists, we give a lot to the doctors, and we give a lot to the favored manufacturers. We buy their support so they will continue to support the government. We have, you know, the finest politicians in Washington, D.C. that money could buy, and they're all subsidized by the very groups the government's giving money to.
Absolutely. Edward Griffin said there's more people now receiving money from the government than the taxpayers, than people paying. And when this imbalance occurs, it starts to become a weapon to be used at the ballot box and so on. So it's redistributive in nature. In fact, Karl Marx, on the second plank of the Communist Manifesto, said he wanted a heavy and progressive income tax, a direct tax on the middle class. And so it's sad to see our country has adopted Marxism and not the vision of our founding fathers. And Benjamin Franklin said it's in the region of ignorance that tyranny begins. And you cannot, Thomas Jefferson, to sum him up, said, you cannot hope to be ignorant and remain free, a free people. It's something that's never happened, he said. Well, the tax issue needs to be understood. It was called the Bureau of External Revenue up until 1862, and then they changed it to the Bureau of Internal Revenue. So you can see the idea that we were always getting external revenue from tariff and other sources, not internally so much. And now it's the Internal Revenue Service. They had to change that name in 1950 to say they're giving service, you know. I like to call it the Department of Confiscation, but that would be more accurate, I guess. Basically today, redistributive in nature, we have the top 1% are paying a third of all taxes, and top 10% pay 65% of all, and there's several that don't, several millions that don't at all. We're the only country in the world, the only country in the world that taxes on worldwide income. That is to mean we don't tax on territorial income like Canada and other countries. Anywhere you are in the world, anywhere, you still have to file a 1040 and a 2555, I believe, with that. In other words, you are an indentured servant no matter where you go on this planet. You were born into this system, and you become an indentured servant. Beardsley Rummel is a man who was he was a Fed chairman in 1945 in New York. He made a rather shocking speech and before the American Bar Association. And the title of it was called Taxes for Revenue Are Obsolete. And as the Fed chairman, he should know exactly why, what that meant, what he was saying. And he said this, short quote, he said, the necessity for a government to tax in order to maintain both its independence and its solvency is true for the state, for states and local governments, but it's not true for the national government. The most important single purpose to be served is the imposition of federal taxes is the maintenance of the dollar, which has stable purchasing power over the years. And I'll explain what that is when we come back.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. And it's important people understand that the dollar is has been the bedrock of the American economic system. The trouble is that the dollar is beginning to lose its value. People throughout the world are beginning to question, you know, do we really want to hang on to dollars? And that's why the value of the dollar is falling today, and with that, the destruction of what people have worked for their whole life. So pick up the story there, Charles.
Well, this gentleman here, Beardsley Rummel, he was responsible also in 1943 for what was called then the victory tax. You have to remember, we've been in war. These are the war years. The government borrowed 60% of its needs through 1940 to 45 through the Fed, through the central bank. And the withholding of he advanced the withholding tax, which we are familiar with today. Prior to that, everybody just totaled up what they owed for the year, and they had to submit it by March 15th of the next year. At this point, though, during the war effort, and it's during war efforts, emergencies, crisis, that the government expands more of its agenda. It grows more. And during this period, this is when they adopted the victory tax, and it was a patriotic thing, buy bonds and all that. But it's stuck ever since. It was meant to be done away with in 1946. They promised they would, but it became so easy now to extract the money from you, from your paycheck, that it's easy to do. But the most important thing Mr. Rummel said in this speech before the American Bar Association, he just flat out said that it's necessary for local governments, like California with $40 billion in debt, it has to be creative and come up with something. The national government, he said, it's not true for the national government. Why is that? They have a credit card. They have a central bank that can just monetize the debt. They can just exchange U.S. Treasury securities over to the Federal Reserve, and in return they get the Federal Reserve notes, and those are debt instruments. And so we're all locked into that debt. The most important thing and purpose, single purpose, for the federal income tax is to contract the M3 money supply. And this is what was needed during World War II. They were printing so much money to monetize the debt to pay for the war machine and so on. This happens throughout history. It happened in World War I. And if there's too much money sloshing around, then, as Ron Paul says, if there's too much water in the milk, you know, people will discover. So it's helpful to have a system by means of contracting the money supply. I'm talking about the broad money supply, cash in circulation, M1, M2, whatever. And think about that. We're paying taxes because think how we've paid this war in Iraq. What's it up to now, Stan? $500 billion, $600 billion?
No, it's about, I think it's about $400 billion now. It'll be $500 billion by the end of this year.
So it's getting up there. And they're paying this. You know how they're paying this. They're just paying it straight through the monetizing of securities over to the Fed, and then they're putting the money to the defense contracts and so on. So it's being paid for. But that means new money that's going out into the private sector. And they have to kind of sop that up. And taxes have a good way of doing that. So it was important. And listen, Nelson Aldrich, Paul Warburg, these people knew this in 1910 and that in their secret meetings. I mean, they knew they needed to have a direct income tax to shrink the money supply if they're going to be creating that much. It just makes sense. So that's where we are today. That's the sad truth. I told this to people. They scratched their head. I'm not sure they still get it, but I hope your listeners do.
Well, I think that people have to understand that, of course, when George Bush wanted to keep the economy going, he cut our taxes. Why did he cut our taxes? So there'd be more money, and that's exactly what happened. And by cutting the taxes, there was more money available out in the general population, so he could stimulate the economy. They wouldn't want to slow the economy down. Why, they'll raise the taxes again, and so there won't be that much money. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go ahead, Charles.
Well, I'll tell you what. It wasn't Bush Jr. that was trying to stimulate the economy. It's Mr. Greenspan and his tenure, for sure. In fact, someone said they noticed that Alan Greenspan has made more visits to the White House during the Bush years than any other time. I just know there's been collusion in this whole thing. So the government can either tax, borrow, or print money, and so they're preferring the printing. You're paying taxes helps extinguish that money because it doesn't go to pay anything. It goes to pay the credit card that already ran out. The IRS is hopelessly corrupt. We know that we're overburdened with it. It's incomprehensible, but it violates our Fifth Amendment. It's against perjury. We must sign things, documents under perjury, and that's self-incrimination. It violates due process. It sidesteps the U.S. tax court, sidestepped the Sixth and Seventh Amendments, and the spirit of those. 13th Amendment is violated, where it says there will be no involuntary servitude in these United States. This is essentially what Alan Keyes calls a slave tax, is what we have. What we really need is some real reform. I'm not for Mr. Forbes' idea of flat tax and so on. That always leaves too much of the government, the IRS, in business. We need something more equitable, like a consumption tax or a national retail sales tax, they call it.
Maybe what we really need to do is cut back on government spending, but there's no chance that's going to happen.
I got an email this week from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, Austrian Economics, and he was arguing if we just went back to Bill Clinton's 1990 first term $1.2 trillion budget, because now it's $2.6 trillion, if we just went back and trimmed to the 1990 budget we had, 17 years ago, that we could just eliminate the IRS altogether. I was using that argument during the Reagan years when I was talking about his first term in 1980 and how it had grown. But I just went through those figures with you, the trillions of dollars. And government's a growth industry. We're not going to arrest this thing. The consumption tax would be equitable because foreigners would even pay. People who come into the country, the underground economy, everything. Everybody would pay because everybody, whenever they spend money, they could limit their own taxes and so on. I think there's a website called fairtax.com or something, but it just makes too much sense. And Ron Paul would add to this, it's really not going to happen because the politicians like the status quo. In other words, they like the Federal Reserve, and they like the tax system right now because it's easier. They don't want to have to tax, they don't want to have to go to the be responsible. In other words, it's easy for them to get away with the Fed operations and so on. And so we basically have what the Cato Institute now calls the Republicrat Party. There's a little distinction between the two. And
I like to say, the Democrats like to tax and tax, spend and spend, and elect and elect. The Republicans like to borrow, spend and spend, and elect and elect.
Well, someone else said the Democrats, the only difference between the two parties is the one party has their foot on the gas pedal, and the other one hits the brakes every now and then. It's not a whole lot of help. Look at Bush. He passed the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003. That lobbed on $6 trillion. According to David Walker, if you go to the CBS interview that he had a month ago, it's on my homepage at chuckcoppus.com, and it's live from 60 Minutes. He said that was the most irresponsible piece of legislation he's ever seen in his life. And he's the chief accountant of the U.S. We're spending ourselves into bankruptcy.
But I think that, Charles, what was quite obvious to me is that the people who are doing this are not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing, and they realize that one day they're going to destroy the value of our currency. It's happened 100 times, 1,000 times down through history. And when they do, they destroy the stability of our society as well. They impoverish our people. And those people who, of course, have not made moves to protect themselves will be immediately impoverished. And where will they look for a solution? Why, they'll look to government, the very people who created the problem.
They'll look to government. They always do. They're looking to them now. Loss of civil liberties and stuff in the war against terrorism and so on. So they always advance these things. Someone said the only difference between a politician and a statesman is a statesman looks out for the next generation, and a politician looks out for the next election.
Right. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Charlie Kopus. Of course, we're going to be talking about his book, America's Financial Day of Reckoning. Fascinating book, lots of great information in here. And, of course, we're only really scratching the surface of this. I think the story of Andrew Jackson and his courageous stand against the central banks. One, as he used to say, everybody's against me, but one man with courage makes a majority. I love Andrew Jackson. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. You go right ahead with the story there.
Well, thanks, Dr. Stan. Incidentally, it's America's Financial Reckoning Day. That's the title of the book, so in case they're looking for that elsewhere. But basically, one of the things that caused me to write this book, I guess, was the report by Dr. Kolakoff, Lawrence Kolakoff, The Coming Generational Storm with Scott Burns. This was a few years ago. And it was all about what David Walker is now saying about unfunded liabilities, the welfare state, and how it's reached to the tune of something like $66 trillion now. Again, incomprehensible figures. But these are the things that ought to concern us as Americans. We can't continue down this road. And so that's what kind of caused me to want to write the book. So as a baby boomer and everything, I think someone said that more people believe in UFOs than they believe that Social Security will be solvent. And what we're setting ourselves up is a terrible generational war, conflict, class warfare, a generational war. And this is not going to be a nice picture. David Walker said on CBS that, and this is all going to start, he said, January 1st, 2008. So these things are closer than we might imagine. I want to kind of move forward where we picked left off maybe last time, but this issue of the trust funds for Social Security needs to be understood, and that is that they are empty. The Federal Insurance Contributions Act, the FICA, goes generally into a general fund in the United States. It was challenged, I can't remember the year, I think it was about 30 years ago. It was challenged, and they basically said in the Helfering and Davis case that it was not earmarked in any way whatsoever. In other words, this was a revealing moment that FICA, your FICA taxes, doesn't go to any kind of designated trust fund or for your benefit or down the road. This is merely a Ponzi scheme. And so this goes straight into the government coffers, and then they put these bonds into the trust fund. And that's on the one hand, it's considered an asset there, but it's a liability because they're spending it. So it's very similar to how the Fed operates. And there are some solutions mentioned in my book, basically HMOs and the personal security systems and some solutions that are not bad on the surface. Medical costs are actually about 4/5 of all the unfunded liabilities, so that needs but they're tending to suggest that we go into the private sector, that the government...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Charles Kupas, and we're talking about his book, America's Financial Reckoning Day. Before we go on, why don't you get your website out and let our listeners know how they can get your book.
Okay, it's America's Financial Reckoning Day, and then they can order this on my website at chuckkupas.com. And that's C-O-P-P-E-S, last name. And it is pronounced Kupas. And you can look it over there. There's some excerpts and interviews and news items and things like that. So they can get it. They can do that.
All right, fine. And then, Chris, why don't you go right ahead with your story?
Well, I think we've said probably enough on the tax thing and Social Security. And we know these things, these issues are looming. There's quite a bit in my book on that regard. Last Friday, we talked about the things that are leading up to a reckoning day. Title of the book. This is focused on America's problem, not the world's financial reckoning day, but America's financial reckoning day, and how this will affect everybody. And we looked at the in the post-war period, basically from about 1970 and on. We suspended the gold standard against our currency for foreign. In other words, foreigners could not turn in their dollars, our dollars, offshore. We promised we would do this in the Bretton-Woods Agreement in 1944, and we reneged on it. Nobody thought back in 1944 that the system would fail or that they would do away with it. And we have basically since then suspended any backing or metallic base, as they put it, for the currency. We do not have, we have a complete fiat currency. And this is pretty scary. This is a slippery slope that we're on. And we, look at our nation, the highest debtor nation in the world, no negative savings rate, you know, haven't had that low since 1933. We're just wallowing in this kind of debt. and the world is not going to take this much longer. And there's going to be a significant challenge, I think, from the euro currency by way of volume and preference and exchange. Certainly the largest economy in the world, 14 trillion, the European Union. So it's a sleeping giant at this point. So a financial reckoning day to America might resemble something that happened in Germany, as we spoke about last time, but these are scary things, and I write about this in my book, kind of set the stage, but this could also, as you said earlier, set us up for an authoritative government, enabling acts, very much the same like Hitler had in the 1930s, and FDR still has or had, and we're basically under force of that now. We're under a state of national emergency right now since September 14th, 2001. That's in my book as well. So we're basically, I believe, and Pat Wood has written the foreword to this book because he's been at this for 30 years along with Anthony Sutton, and showing that there's always a Hegelian strategy of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. In other words, contingency planning or crisis management. An economic crisis is looming on the horizon, and it could be as soon as 20, 30 months from now. Some, and I say that to some people, some are shocked. Others say, you know, do you think it'll be that long? We're facing a crisis here, and I think they are preparing to exploit just such a crisis.
In fact, I really believe that is why they passed this last October the Military Commission Act, and then, of course, they passed the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act. And basically what that said was, in case of a national emergency of any sort, it could be some sort of a natural occurrence, some sort of a disaster, an epidemic of some sort, civil disorder, the president could declare a national emergency and impose martial law on America. Those are the exact words, martial law in America. Not only that, but they suspended the Posse Comitatus Act so they can, of course, bring in the military to use against the people. Why would they do that? I mean, that's protected us since the 1870s.
Right.
And then, of course, they also put in legislation that allows the president now to go ahead and mobilize the National Guard without the permission of the state governor. So, I mean, never before, always before, he had to get the permission of the state governor, and the state governor could say, you can't use our troops. We need them here. But that is no longer true. Why at this time in history, October 2006, did they pass that legislation in the middle of the night? And even Liberal Senator Patrick Leahy said, you know, this is frightening legislation because it encourages the president to declare martial law. And we have a four-tape set on that. If anybody's out there would like to go over those interviews we've done, go ahead, Chuck.
Well, you can Google that on the internet. Probably it was a secret signing ceremony, October 17th, Public Law 109, 364, and 366. These federalized the armed forces to be used as domestic police. This is a wholesale violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, which you mentioned. So these, you know, while you slept, I mean, these things are going on. And it's strengthening government. Ron Paul's sitting in Congress watching all of this. And here's a man, Ron Paul. He's going to be at the Reagan Library, hosted by Nancy Reagan, May 3rd on MSNBC. So write that down, folks. Here's Ron Paul going to be debating nine GOP candidates, like John McCain and Giuliani. And he's going to make more sense in 10 minutes. He's going to state America's situation in about 15 minutes and not beat around the bush at all. He sees all of this coming. He's warning about this. Lou Dobbs, incidentally, seems to be getting very close to understanding some of this, although he keeps throwing up his hands and saying he can't understand what's going on and he can't believe how stupid we are and these sort of things.
No, I don't think we're stupid at all. I think the people in charge know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to find out until, of course, freedom is simply become a remembrance of things past.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm a veteran. I sometimes take the veteran, the VA band, down to a clinic, and here's 10 Army veterans with their baseball caps and American flag pins and VFW and all. I start talking. I usually take over the you know, the conversation in the van. If they start getting me going, and I, they usually get about 2 or 3 hours. They get quite an earful. And I tell them about the North American Union. We're beginning to hear about the North American Union agenda, and we need to know who's behind this movement and why they're doing that. And I'd like to get into that right now because this is something that we're beginning to see on television. We're going to hear more focused debate, I believe, but it's an agenda that's it just seems unstoppable what's going on right now. This was basically all stirred up during the Rockefeller front organizations known as the Council of the Americas during in the 1960s, 1965. Recently, this same group hosted the Summit of the Americas in Miami in 1994, and this was under Bill Clinton, where he announced the Free Trade Area of the Americas. And you can also Google that. The FTAA represents 34 nations. It's a regional trading bloc in this hemisphere. It includes impoverished nations like Belize, Haiti, Trinidad, and Chile, and Paraguay, and Tobago, and so on. These are not exactly industrial powers, you know. 800 million people in this trading bloc. They're proposing a new secretariat in Panama or Miami, San Juan or Atlanta. There's a few others. This is the larger agenda of the these think tanks, these elitist globalist think tanks. And what we're beginning to see now is the incremental move towards these things. NAFTA was passed, of course, in 1994. 1,700 pages of legislation with fast-track legislation. That means an up-and-down vote, no debate. And they just ran this thing through. As Pat Wood would tell you, this is how they always do this stuff. Tucked in there was the World Trade Organization legislation, which was adopted in 1995. That's 26,000 pages. The General Agreement on Trade and Services, this is passed in 95, gives L1 visas to foreigners. So that's why everybody out there, when you call Dell Computers or anybody and you get someone in India or Sri Lanka or the Caribbean or something, it's because they've outsourced all of their customer service jobs and so on, exporting these things. CAFTA was the next legislation they passed in July of 95, and that was a small, involved six countries. It was the original goal of the FTAA to be adopted by 2005. In that same year, in March 2005, at the Bush Ranch in Texas, there was something called the North American Summit. And this was attended by Vincente Fox and Paul Martin, leaders at the time. And they were calling for a seamless North American market, and they wanted to adopt this, and it's still on their agenda to adopt it by 2010. This was all put together by Robert A. Pasteur. He's a CFR member, director of the Center for North American Studies. You can go to spp.gov. That's spp.gov if you want to see more on this. And the North American Union is proposing a biometric passport, seamless NAFTA perimeter, a new Amero currency, which will replace or be a basket currency, replacing the failing U.S. dollar, and a super corridor highway built up through Texas. And that's pretty interesting. If you go to their website, you can see it fully laid out right on their page. It's called NASCOCorridor.com. NASCO, NASCO Corridor. This is treason. The Logan Act was adopted, I think, back in early 1700s, or the 1790s or something. The Logan Act states that no private citizen can be involved in America's foreign policy. It can't go out there and start creating these kind of summits and these kind of schemes for reorganizing government. Nancy Pelosi might have been called on this. They've challenged Jesse Jackson on it before, and Jimmy Carter, and these people. And so private citizens, elitists in our society, are going about, as Lou Dobbs says, without consulting the Congress or the American people, and this is the way they think. If you want to see where this is going, Vincente Fox was in Madrid in 2002, and he made this statement. He said, eventually, our long-range objective is to establish with the U.S., but also with Canada and other trading our other trading partner, a symbol of connections and institutions similar to those created by the European Union. The goal is what Brzezinski called progressive regionalization, and others call it harmonization. Harmonization. You get the idea here that loose immigration policies since 1965, during the Civil Rights era, they suspended them. We don't have any quotas. They can just come in however they want now. And, of course, they always vote for, you know which party they always vote for. But loose immigration is playing into this because it's harmonizing our cultures and blending them together within this whole NAFTA perimeter.
Well, I think as I look at America today, how dramatically it's changed since when I was growing up in the 1950s. And a tremendous increase in the number of people, who come from foreign countries. And not that these people can't be good Americans, but you go, for instance, into Los Angeles today, and you turn on the radio, and you hear all the programs in Korean and Vietnamese and Spanish and Chinese. And suddenly, you realize that this is no longer an American city. And the same thing is true with many of our other cities, because these people are not here to become part of our society, but to form enclaves as we move into a multicultural, multilingual society, because our leaders are really dedicated to changing and transforming America. And it's the old idea that was laid out by Nimrod at the Tower of Babel, and you actually can see the pictures in Europe of the Tower of Babel. And that is the epitome of the plan for the European Union. It is the identical plan for the North American Union, and they're trying to form North American Union, the European Union, the South American Union, an African Union, an Asian Union, and then they're going to join them all together into this one world government. That's the real objective of these people who have no loyalty to America, because they look at the world differently. They have a different worldview.
Well, remember, it was called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Remember, it's the Union. So you got to have these republics out there, these trading blocs. We're basically up against corporate fascism in America by America's ruling elite to create a feudalist society.
That's exactly what it's about. They want a return to feudalism, a ruling elite, and then impoverish the rest of us. And when we have America's financial reckoning day, the average American is going to get wiped out, and everything he has in his pension fund and his insurance policy and his bonds and his annuities, they're all denominated in dollars. And when the dollar is worthless, why, of course, you'll lose everything you spent your whole life working for.
Well, as I tell my clients, you need to protect yourself against U.S. dollar-denominated assets. In other words, you need to lower your exposure, have a hedge strategy, defensive strategy, but that's another subject. And what we're up against, what Lou Dobbs is relating and so on, about loose trade policies and exporting our industries and so on, these groups encourage free trade. They're, after all, these are the same groups that are always behind the trade agreements, right? Because they don't want to have quotas. They want to lower the tariffs and taxes, and they want to have this big trade zone where they can go out and employ what they call round trip trade or turnaround exports. A turnaround export is like the maquiladoras in Mexico, right across the border, thousands of them. And they're losing out, however, to the Chinese workforce quite a bit. But they export their goods to be manufactured down there. They'll assemble them and then bring them back into the U.S. It's a round-trip trade. China, of course, has most favored nation trading status, which benefits the corporate socialists, that are using all of this. China now, 15% of China's exports go to Walmart shelves. 15%. So staggering is that it's 2% of China's gross domestic product. Walmart is now the largest Fortune 500 company in the world. First, it's beat out IBM, ExxonMobil, everybody. And that just happened in recent years. In 1993, the U.S., think about this, before the NAFTA Treaty in 94, and I debated this on radio, on Texas radio, telling people that this was not going to be good for the U.S. We had a trade surplus in 93 with Canada and Mexico. Now we have a trade deficit of $50 billion with Canada and $40 billion with Mexico. So it was sold to us a bill of goods.
But, of course, now we have a trade surplus with China or something. We're pushing $60 or $80 billion a year or something like that.
Oh, it's huge.
I mean, it's just unfathomable. It's so it's impossible to understand. Our trade deficit this year is going to be over $800 billion.
Yep.
And you can't spend your way into prosperity. You can't spend more than you're taking in indefinitely. Eventually comes the day of reckoning. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up our program this evening with Chuck Kupis. All right, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. Boy, this hour's gone rapidly.
I know, and I'm trying to talk as fast as I can.
Just take your time. Talk too fast, people won't remember what you say. Talk slower, and they'll remember more.
They'll have to get my book. This is the kind of stuff that Pat and I have known over the years and so on, but we have to ask ourselves, who are these people? Who are these people that are advancing this global elitist vision for America? The Congressional Institute in 2003 issued a poll and 80% said they believe in a close network of special interests around the country. So it's kind of suspected out there. It's just they don't know where to put their finger on the thing, you know. And we're not going to have time today to talk about this much, but I hope next Friday when I'm on the program we'll pick it up, because Carol Quigley, as you know, wrote an important book in 1966 called Tragedy and Hope. And it's thick. How thick is it? 1,700 pages, I think?
1,342.
How many? Yeah.
1,342.
he was part of the Anglo establishment, as Sutton put it. Another, he outlined the goal for world system of financial control, he called it, by the central banks, and he said cooperative politicians, and that both parties must be, quote, almost identical. And I ask you, isn't this what we see happening in the U.S. today? And we're confused. We're going to throw out these rascals and put those people in. Ah, Bush is no good. You know, now we're going to get, Hillary, of course, John McCain, or how about Newt Gingrich? Both of them, CFR Bilderberger members. I mean,
well, don't forget John Edwards. He is actually the man who I think has been picked to carry the mantle for the Democrats. Said he was picked by the Bilderbergers 4 years ago to run for vice president. It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out of the Democratic ticket. I don't think we've seen the Republican candidate yet.
No, these are men of opportunity. They climb, as I put it in my book, they climb up the ladder of success, and then they want to pull up the ladder behind them.
But, of course, these people have a different worldview. And, of course, they are all controlled by the same little group that Professor Quigley talks about in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. We're out of time now, because tomorrow, on Friday, you're going to be on the afternoon program talking to a different audience. But this is a great audience here, this first hour in the evening, so I'd really like to get you back here to talk about these same things again. Because I'd like our supporters in the great Northwest and in the East to hear what you have to say. Anyway, good night. God bless. Thanks very much.
Thank you. God bless you, Stan.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up the program here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and I do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we have our network reaching across America and about 60 different outlets every week. The other thing, the exciting thing, is if you can actually go to Global Star, www.globalstar, and then, of course, when you come up on the Internet screen, you go to site number 4. You can hear our programs 24 hours a day between myself and Joyce Riley and a couple of our friends. We have 24-hour-a-day radio, so you don't need a satellite radio. You can get it on the Internet, and, of course, we have then our own outlet. Many of our programs are broadcast several times there. encourage others to listen. Now, of course, my programs are archived and on MP3 on my website of RadioLiberty.com, but they're also available on Global Star. So 24 hours a day and then the repeat program. So if you want to hear something constantly, why, of course, you can go to that site. Now, how do we begin to understand what's going on? Well, first of all, we do carry Professor Quigley's books. I'd like to think I know a little bit about Professor Quigley, who wrote the book that Charlie was talking about. I spent many weeks back at Georgetown University going to Professor Quigley's papers, and, of course, in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, I explain about the secret society that became the Council on Foreign Relations. That is America's invisible government today. So you need, of course, get my talk, Brotherhood of Darkness, and it's available on DVD, or it's available on the video, or there's a book. And then once you have a basic understanding of the spiritual forces that are energizing these people, my talk, Forbidden Secret, it's a new talk we've just done in January, and we tell you the secret that has been passed down through the ages for the last 5,000 years. It was known to Plato. It was known to Aristotle. It was known to Alexander the Great. Have you ever wondered how Alexander, with a band of 35,000 Macedonian soldiers, was able to take on the greatest armies in the world, including that of Darius, and defeat them? I mean, would they have hundreds of thousands of soldiers? Well, of course, Alexander understood the secret. And you will, too, after you've listened to my talk. And, of course, we explained to you why, of course, this is such a dangerous secret that nobody would ever, of course, reveal this publicly. Forbidden Secret, available in video and in a DVD, and there's a syllabus that goes with that as well. And then, of course, we want to mention Chris Pinto's wonderful DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and then, of course, Riddles in Stone. You can't understand why we are in the Middle East today unless you see Riddles in Stone and understand the secret architecture, the secret message in the architecture of our nation's capital. And, of course, what the secret destiny of America was. And I should point out that I am in both of those DVDs, the first one, award-winning documentary, has, I think, three or four awards as one of the, well, certainly the best documentary, New York Film Festival, best documentary of last year. And I hope Riddles in Stone will come out as well. And then, of course, there's so much more that is available from Radio Liberty. Please go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, if you'd like more information. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to just understand what's going on financially, you need to get my talk, Financial Tsunami, available in both DVD and video, and then, of course, the syllabus goes with that. And you need to begin preparing yourself for the difficult times that lie ahead, because most people are going to be wiped out when, of course, America's financial day of reckoning comes. So then, of course, pray for America and pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this hour we're going to have with us David Sibley, and David Sibley comes from Ready Reserve Foods, and we, of course, work with David, and we think he does a great job of supplying long-term storage foods, and certainly if you'd like to know more about that, you can give us a call, and we will be glad to make sure that you get one of his catalogs free of charge. But David has been concerned, as I have, about what's happening to the food supply. Why are the beehives collapsing in certain parts of the world? And we read these stories out there about what's going on with the bees. The bees are certainly flying away from the hives, and they're just not coming back again. Why is that happening? And then, of course, how secure is our food supply? Now, for the individual out there, you have to understand that we're on the verge of a major war in the Middle East. And if we go to war with Iran, why, of course, there are going to be serious consequences, and not just in the Middle East. You must understand that the leaders of Iran today are deeply involved in the occult. In fact, there's a fascinating book written by Joel Rosenberg called Epicenter. And as you read that, at one time, in fact, I just read this 2 days ago, and I had to read it through three times to consider the implications. President Ahmadinejad, that little guy, we've seen him with he looks like he has about a 2 days' growth of beard, and of course, he wears a little, a nice little brown coat and a khaki coat and. And here's the president of Iran. Well, he was going to a big meeting the other day, but he went into seclusion for several hours so he could visit with the Mahdi and get instructions. He could visit with the Mahdi? Now, you have to understand that the Mahdi, of course, is the figure who disappeared in the 9th century. It is the Muslim belief, at least because of the Hejatua society, which Ahmadinejad belongs to, that the Mahdi will come back. We'll be brought back to life, and of course will rule the Muslim world. In fact, he will rule the whole world. He is the counterpart of the Jewish Messiah, the counterpart of the Buddhist or the Indian Maitreya, the counterpart of the Christian Christ. We're all waiting for this world leader to come. And, of course, the Mahdi is the one who's going to come. But they believe he'll be brought about by an international conflict. And they intend intentionally to precipitate a nuclear holocaust. And out of this nuclear holocaust, the Mahdi has said, I will return. And President Ahmadinejad met with the Mahdi. Well, wait a minute. The Mahdi isn't. This is a demonic figure. This is basically a supernatural figure. And if you've read any of the stories of Maitreya, I mean, he can sort of materialize and disappear, and the people who've actually seen him, like Wayne Peterson, we carry a book by Wayne Peterson, where he talks about having met Maitreya. He just materializes and disappears, and he looks just exactly like the Mahdi does. And President Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, is holding meetings with the Mahdi. This is all supernatural, ladies and gentlemen, and there's a supernatural force that is propelling the world towards World War III. And I fear this will be a nuclear confrontation because they want it to be, and it may be only a matter of weeks or months away. We'll be right back here with David Sibley. All right, David, how are you tonight?
Fine, Doctor. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Now, I want you to tell us what you've learned about bees.
Well, I've taken up with a local beekeeper to learn the bee business. It's out of curiosity and out of, shall we say, a concern for what's going on. I mean, it's trying to learn what makes these little guys not do what they're supposed to be doing.
Little girls, actually, right.
The worker bee is shall we say, an incomplete female. All the work is done by the females. And they were not appear to be experiencing the colony collapse problems here in this part of Southern California. But the things that I've been reading about, some beehive keepers are losing over 90% of their bees. Again, and it's nothing they've seen before. It's when an infestation of a fungus or mite begins to kill bees, especially in the hives, other bees just push them out, and you find dead bees around the hive. In this case, there are no bees left. They're just gone. When I say gone, there's a queen and a small handful still in the hive, but they don't. It's not a working colony. It's not functional. It's not big enough. What appears is the young bees, young adults, come out of their larval stage and come out of the hive to go to work, to make orientation flights, fly away, and just never come back. This is one of the problems I think they're having, trying to find out what is causing this, because they can't find any, shall we say, corpus delicti to get after, to do an autopsy on and figure out what is causing this problem. But as I study more and read more, the poor little bees are just stressed out to the breaking point with mites and funguses and viruses. They're under constant attack, and they're very short life of about 6 weeks. So anything that new that has come along in the form of stress could be enough to destroy a bee colony. And I honestly believe from everything that I've read, okay, because I haven't experienced it firsthand, I think it's something we have done to them in the form of pesticides. That's we've pushed them over the edge. There's a new form of pesticides, a nicotine-based pesticide. It's only been out for a couple of years, so it fits the timeline about right. They're called neonicotinoids. And
hold
nicotine...
on, though. We'll be right back here with David
right.
Sibley. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David Sibley is our guest this evening. He's been out working with a beekeeper here recently. Now, of course, his real job, of course, is long-term food storage and its preparation, but he's been out trying to learn about the bees and keeping us abreast of what's going on. And of course, in Southern California, where he's actually out there working with the bees, with this beekeeper, he said that the colonies are not doing badly. But in many parts of the country, why, of course, 80, 90% of the hives have just collapsed. There's nothing there. A queen bee, a few other bees, but they can't work, they can't function. And, you know, I mean, where is this? Is this just in the eastern part of the United States, Northern California? What about Europe and other countries?
Well, it appears to be in about 30-plus states in the Union now. It's now in Europe, in Italy, and France, and in Scotland, and spreading to other parts of the world. That is, to me, the confusing parts, because I cannot find out if this new pesticide has been used in that part of the world.
Now, of course, there's a new pesticide. It's sort of a nicotine-based pesticide, is that it?
Yes, and it's a pesticide, and it's coming up through the plant, and the EPA knew when this pesticide came out that it had an effect on a bee's ability to make memory, and that appears to be the problem, but maybe just slight enough that it wasn't going to be much of a problem. What they're finding is this pesticide appears to be mixing with other more commonly used insecticides that I have seen, and it increases its strength 1,000-fold. So worker bees go out, they collect this pollen, they come back. This is fed to the, made to honey and fed to the larvae. The larvae grow up with being fed this inferior, basically toxic food. And they probably aren't developing right. Their little brains are not developing right. They come out, they're, I can't give a word for their condition, but they're not right. They're not functional bees.
Maybe they got autism, something like autism.
They could be Alzheimer's for bees. I don't know. I mean, that's my own making for it. But that the end result is they don't come back. So
the thing is, it is amazing that the bees always did know where the hive was. I mean, how does a little tiny bee know where the hive is? But we've done something, and something is happening. Of course, David thinks it's a combination of various insecticides. And what is frightening is the Environmental Protection Agency knew that these nicotine-based fertilizers would actually, of course, cause problems with the bees, and they've released it anyway. Now, basically, how does this nicotine-based fertilizer work? Does it go into the ground?
You know, I have not been able to find any information on exactly how it's applied. I'm going to assume it's some sort of spray, but it's coming up in the plant. It's systemically brought up in the plant and into the pollen.
See, that's really what's so strange about this, because ordinarily the plants are a lot smarter than people are. They will reject things. For instance, most plants will not bring fluoride up out of the soil. Only the plants that will do that are the tea plants, specifically. But yeah, they will reject the fluoride because they know it's a poison. Of course, we're smarter than they are. We put it in our water and our food, and then we poison the minds of our children. But this is a strange one. If they're bringing this nicotine up, and then it's getting into the pollen, and then, of course, being fed to the young bees. Now, there have actually been congressional hearings held. Why haven't we heard anything about what was said or what was decided?
There was very limited communication about the testimony before Congress. But we have to look at the way that Congress, all of our lives, they've held hearings usually after a disaster or while it's happening. Then they'll go back and talk about it for a couple of years. Well, we don't have a couple of years. Spring waits for no man. And in this case, it's not waiting for the bee either. The point I'm trying to make is the problem is here, it's now, and we're going to have immediate effects of this if the spring, like where I live, for instance. I live amongst orange groves here in Southern California. The trees are just bright white with flowers, and the fragrance is devastating. All that is there to attract pollinators. Well, that period only lasts not even a month. Here in Southern California, and then the pollination period is over. If the bee is not there to pollinate, we don't have any oranges.
Is it possible to actually pollinate these things by hand?
It's been tried before. I was reading where they've tried pollination by spray, even small bombs that spread the stuff out. Other animals like hummingbirds, there's other types of bees. Solitary bees I'm reading about, I have actually seen them. Other insects that are pollinators, but nothing like a honeybee. Nothing like a honeybee, because they're just so prolific, or were.
All right, fine. So basically we need those bees, and of course, as you pointed out, certainly our fruits and vegetables are really totally reliant upon them, and certainly the almond crop is here in California, a very important crop that we have, and of course that could very well be entirely lost because of this, couldn't it?
Well, you don't know whether the bee has done its job until the tree bears fruit or it does not bear fruit. So it's kind of one of those things we have no control over, and you really have to put a lot of faith in the little guys getting the job done. But if they're not out there, they can't get the job done. There's just not enough of them, it appears.
Now, of course, ordinarily they bring hives in from all across America, don't they, for the almond crop here in California?
That's right. They will transport bees from the East Coast to the West Coast because the almond tree only has a couple-week period that it can be pollinated. So it has to be a very intense effort. And henceforth, if this is not a problem, say, with the insecticides. Let's assume it's some sort of pathogen or fungus. Now, all the bees intermix around the country then. They're not, like, regionally kept. And that could be one of the problems, too. I've been reading now recently, there are studies that lend themselves to the fact that cell phones and microwaves may be messing up their abilities to make memories. And Morgellons disease, that's a little fibrous disease. I don't know if you've ever discussed it, but there's the jury's still out. What about the pesticide is, to me, it seems to be the most obvious, because the problem began to manifest itself just shortly after this new pesticide was introduced.
Now, a lot of people have been talking about some of the genetically modified food, like this BT corn that we have, where, of course, they put a gene in there that'll kill caterpillars, and if it'll kill caterpillars, will it kill bees? Has anybody really looked at this? It should be a fairly easy thing to evaluate, I would think, for anybody, if they really were doing the research on it.
Could very well be. But again, this is pure conjecture on my part.
Well, do we have scientists who are working on it, David? What do we know for sure?
There's several universities. The University of Pennsylvania appears to have taken the lead on it. Several Western universities are involved. The Department of Agriculture is working on it. But I honestly, this is my own opinion, I honestly think they know what has caused it. They're just not saying anything, because it's going to be a big, if it manifests itself like it appears like it's trying to, there's going to be a lot of finger pointing as to who done what, or who didn't do anything, or who didn't do their job. It's strange. The silence appears to be deafening, and the fact that it's not being, the problem is not being promoted publicly, very loudly, just a very soft sell, is, to me, suspect in itself.
Well, of course, what sort of a fruits and vegetables do you actually have that are, do you have freeze-dried, or are these just dried?
Pardon me, sir?
I mean, you actually carry...
We carry a full line of fruits and vegetables that are dehydrated.
These are dehydrated fruits and vegetables?
Yes, they are.
All right, fine. And of course, they'll last for how long ordinarily?
Oh, you can get 7 to 15 years properly stored.
All right, fine. And so you're talking about apples, and what other sorts of fruits do you have that are dried?
All the legumes, beans, corn, rice, milk, dairy products, every raw food pretty much that you could buy in daily life, so you could mix your regular meals up with them and just rehydrate them, place them in your recipes, and pretty much cook as normal.
All right, so they'll last for good long periods of time. So they're available now, but what happens, of course, if we're not pollinating the trees this year and next year? And then, of course, that's about a third of our diet, isn't it, that comes from pollinated products?
Yes, the bee is responsible both for about one-third of what you eat. So let's take this worst case. Say the bees default on their job and through no fault of their own, and we lose a third of our crop. Things could get very, very, shall we say, ugly and tight, but they'd better fix themselves by next year. Now, you couple in with the droughts and the crazy weather they're having, the freezes and the rains in the east, and if we have a summer like we had last summer, food could become a major, major expensive and in short supply problem here in the United States.
Well, because one of the problems we're having is, of course, so much of the corn is being used to make ethanol with. Of course, it's not economically feasible, so the government subsidizes it. Price of corn is doubled. It's going to double, massively increase the price of meat and of poultry, because, of course, the chicken eat corn, and of course, and there's not a problem facing America today that a new government program won't make worse. Well, David picked the story up there. Do you want to get into the wheat rust?
Well, there's a new form of wheat rust. Wheat rust is a fungus that attacks the stalk of a wheat plant. And it was back in the 70s, through big, big international efforts, rust-resistant forms of wheat were developed and spread out through the world. Well, since the 70s, the Green Revolution, there's been not much in the way of problem in wheat rust. There's been what are what are called bunts, other types of things. But now there's a new form of rust out, and it's mainly manifested itself in East Africa that is just starting to destroy wheat crops again. Well, in that 30 years, once we had this whipped, the abilities in the institution, there's one specifically in Mexico, where the research is done for these to develop these rust-resistant species of wheat, has basically atrophied. There's been no interest in it because there's been no need for it. Well, they're trying to spool up that effort now, and this can take years. Well, the earth doesn't have, if this spreads very rapidly, we can't, there's not much of a boo-boo factor, shall we call it, and especially when it comes to the grain cereals. The third world is very dependent upon on grains like wheat. A couple failures there, and we could lose a good portion of the earth's population because of starvation. Again, you couple that with the drought. Australia is in what they're calling a 1,000-year drought. Navigable rivers in Australia are no longer navigable. Their export of wheat, which was their largest crop, does not look like there's going to even be an export this year. Well, countries like India, for years now, have been very dependent upon wheat coming out of places like Australia to make up for their shortfalls. So everything is connected here. The Australians may not be exporting, they might even be importing food this year. They'll become a net importer because of their drought. Well, that doesn't do India any good. I'm just picking, because this is a very simple chain here. Australia may be looking to the United States for certain forms of supply. Well, if we begin to falter, we could have global famine.
Well, of course, we don't have the rust here yet on our wheat, do we?
No, we do not. But it is carried by the wind, and it can be carried by people. So there's quiet international cooperation going on right now. And it sounds to me, from what little I can find on the subject, that they're really beginning to, shall we say, sweat, that this thing could be a real problem. But then again, maybe they aren't sweating. Like you, I believe there's a movement to eliminate a good portion of the Earth's population. And what a great way to do it.
Well, I think it's rather frightening when we realize there really are people who have a different worldview who do not value the sanctity of human life. Because, of course, they believe that there are too many people on Earth, that they are using up the natural resources. We will not be able to have sustainable development. And they have openly talked about reducing the population of the Earth by 1 billion, 2 billion, 3 billion, 5 billion, 6 billion people. They really want to kill off the majority of the population. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David has simply been talking about the wheat rust, which is really sweeping a lot of parts. What is it, primarily Africa that
Africa, yes. It's a fungus that turns the wheat, it blackens the wheat and makes it fall over, it appears.
And apparently it just wipes out the whole of fields. And, of course, this is a factor in Africa. Now, fortunately, it seems to be predominant in Africa, but the fear is this could spread into the existing wheat crops. In years past, of course, they had more resistant wheat, and it could be replaced, but it'll take a time to go through this process. And then, of course, David's pointing out that in Australia they've had a great drought this year, and the wheat crop and other crops are not doing well at all, and India is so dependent upon Australian wheat, and Australia may not be able to be exporting wheat again this year.
I was reading about China. China is beginning to bump up against her limits of growth, that farmland is being turned over for industrial uses to the point where they may not be able to sustain this massive industrial growth because of the expense of their agriculture. So the earth and the people of the earth are beginning to hit limits to their growth that they've never seen before. And there really physically is, you can't, no no way around it. You can't make more water. You can't make more arable farmlands. And the farmlands that have always been quite predictable are changing with the change in the global climate. In other words, our Midwest, for instance, is just getting hotter and drier. Our big grain states, they're pulling the Ogallala Aquifer down to the point where it's actually going dry in a few places. And that means the rest of the aquifer is getting low. And that is kind of their ace in the hole. And they need water, they pull it out of the aquifer. So things are getting quite precarious on the food production end. And every day, the Earth adds over 190,000 people net to its number, 71 plus million a year. And that's after attrition, after death. So we need more and more of less and less, and it's getting to manifest itself in hard-to-get or shortage problems.
Well, because we're seeing real problems as far as the availability of corn, because, of course, they are using so much for ethanol, and then, of course, we do not have the massive supplies of corn. We have, pardon me, of corn and wheat we once had. We had just, you know, these certain warehouses just teeming with a gear or two supply of wheat, but we've given most of that away to Africa and to other countries. So, you know, at least there is the potential for getting into some real food shortages. We do not know, of course, what's going to happen, but at least certainly we're concerned about the availability of corn. We're concerned about the availability of a full wheat crop this year. We know that the corn prices have gone up phenomenally. Do you have any idea what's happening to the wheat prices?
No, I do not. I haven't been studying those.
Well, maybe somebody out there in the listening audience does. If they'd like to give us a call, we'd like to know what you're thinking. And if you're out there and you're a farmer, we'd like to know your thoughts. How are the crops going to be this year? Have we lost them because of the extremes of weather? How is the, certainly the price of the diesel fuel, which is quite high here in California? Of course, our gasoline is over $3 a gallon, and certainly so is diesel. How is that going to impact upon the farmer? And then what is happening with the rice? My understanding, of course, is that they planted these genetically modified rice, saying there's nothing to worry about. It can't spread into other fields, and it has spread into other fields, and they've contaminated the rice crop here in California to the point where some countries will not take California rice. What's going on there, David? Have you looked into that at all?
Yes, it's kind of I looked a little bit at it, and there's this, like a firewall. California rice is kind of off by itself, it appears to be. Other states that don't have it, like Arkansas in particular, they're a big rice-growing state, they seem to be booming, but California rice does not appear to be in too much, or seems to be in less favor around the world.
Well, but why is that? What's wrong with the genetically modified rice? Why are people concerned about it?
Well, for good reason. Just that, genetically modified. Nature has spent millions of years refining things, and man comes along, discovers something, and in less than a quarter of a century thinks that he knows better. You know, man needs to... His arrogance could be what is his demise.
Yeah, well, it may very well be. Well, we sort of think maybe God's had a hand in that as well. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Sibley, and yours, David, is on the front lines of this battle because this is his business. And certainly, right now, of course, there is no shortage of food, is there, David?
No, there is not. But we're only about 50 to 55 days away from starvation. There are no massive warehouses full of food. We're just one crop cycle away from disaster. And we might be right there, Doctor, with between the bees, the freezes in the Carolinas and in the East Coast, in Kentucky, Now New York City got, what, something like 6 inches of rain? Well, farmers, their spring plant may be shot, or at least could be late getting into the field. Now, California, we have a water problem. The Central Valley of California, and California itself, when you include the Imperial Valley and stuff, produces 25% of this country's food. All right? Now, we only had, here in Southern California, 3 inches of rain. We normally get 13, 14 inches. The worst year on record was a little over 6 inches, and we cut that in half. Now,
because, of course, you haven't finished the season yet either. You can still get some more, can't you?
Yes, but never in history has a season come this late. Now, with the change in the climate, what happens is that the storms come in. The lower atmosphere is warming up. The storms come in off of the Pacific, out of the Gulf of Alaska, and run into our Sierra Nevada mountains. Well, they get pushed mechanically. They get lifted. They have to go over. As they lift, they cool. They drop their snow. And we get a snowpack, and that's where the majority of our water is stored. Well, as the lower atmosphere warms up, the storms get higher and higher and higher up in the Sierra, and the snow level gets higher and thinner to where there's not a lot. The snowpack in California in some areas was down 70% for the year. Now, we've snuck by before with a low snowpack, but we haven't had a series of good winters in a long time. And this climate change is going to have an effect. California's Central Valley puts out two, sometimes three crop cycles a year. I mean, because it's a constant growing season. You've got the weather, the sunlight all the time. You've got the fertile ground. All you do is add water. Water is up in the mountains. You bring it down through our canal systems, water the plants, and we have constant food. Well, the chain has been broken. There's not a lot of water. And disaster looms when the farmers can't continue this machine that we have here in the California.
Oh, that's all. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. My guest is David Sibley. And David, would you like to get your website out there?
Well, you can take a look at our product line at ReadyReserveFoods.com.
And, of course, if you'd like one of their catalogs, we'll be glad to send you one from Ready Reserve Food. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free catalog so you know what David's talking about. And, Sydney, you've been around in business, what, 35 years?
Since 1972.
That's a long time. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, do you have any question about the things we're talking about, give us a call. My telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But I think it's really so interesting. At this time in history, said that we're having trouble with the beehives collapsing all across America, indeed in Europe as well. And this is really very much of a concern as far as the pollination of our fruits and vegetables. And certainly the supplies are fine now, but what about this year and the coming year? When will the bees learn how to get back to the hive? Or have we destroyed the minds of these bees by something we've done, something we've introduced in the environment? And then, of course, the wheat rust. The rising price of corn, because, of course, we've interfered with the normal markets of corn and we're siphoning off large amounts of corn to make gasohol. And then, of course, this has an impact upon the price of meat and the price of chicken and the price of eggs and the price of dairy products. And all of these things are interrelated. And then, of course, down the line, what impact is this going to have on the availability of a food supply? Could there be some sort of a major crisis? Well, anyway, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. You know, we hear about biblical plagues. We've never seen a plague, a famine here in the United States that we see about, that we hear about them in other countries. Africa, Ethiopia, certainly in China, and in North Korea. but we've never known hunger here in the United States. We've always had more than our share, but then, of course, we were also a nation, I believe, that has been blessed by God. Will God continue to bless and protect America? Our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Herman calling from Carmel. Hi, Herman. How are you doing?
Good evening. I have a good friend who is a member of a Mormon church in Utah, and he said at their general conference recently, their world leader, Hinckley, told the membership, admonished them to get ready for tough times and to store up, and they traditionally are asked to store up food and so forth. But do you have any comments on that?
Well, of course, is this unusual? We know that the Mormons have, you know, this has always been one of the tenets in their faith. But is this something completely new that has not been stressed before?
Well, he told me that there was an urgency from their leadership, as if they sensed something is on the horizon.
Well, I'll tell you what, Sherman, I sense that something's on the horizon as well. And this is the reason I asked David to come on with us. I really have only simply my basic awareness of the fact we are moving rapidly into a period of chaos and crisis in this country. If we do go to war with Iran, I think the average American thinks, oh, well, that's going to be pretty hard on the Iranian people. The Iranians are talking openly about attacking the United States. If we attack them, they feel they have a right to attack us. And you have to understand the mentality of the leaders of Iran. They are not rational at all. There are people there who really want to create a worldwide nuclear confrontation. And the reason they want to is because that is how they are going to bring back the return of the Mahdi, this supernatural individual who is going to rule the Muslim world and bring all of the world under Muslim rule. And to the average American, you say, that's crazy talk. Well, it may be to you and I. But if Joel Rosenberg's book is correct, and that's the book I referred to earlier called The Epicenter, why, of course, President Ahmadinejad has regular meetings with this ethereal individual who I believe comes from the other dimension. And just as Maitreya comes from the other dimension, I believe these are demonic beings. So the Mahdi would appear to be, and President Ahmadinejad, the leader of Iran, is certainly, and he has supporters in the government there, is part of this movement. So we're not dealing with rational people who would act in a rational manner. And think of the havoc that they could create in this country with one or two major terrorist attacks. And we have, of course, sources of information we've had for a number of years, going back to the early 1990s, that Iran has had a small number of nuclear weapons for some time, and it would be relatively easy to deliver them from simply a passing ship. If we attack Iran, why, of course, you could expect that there's going to be dramatic consequences for America.
Case in point, just closing the Strait of Hormuz, which is 6 miles wide and basically under their control, would stop approximately 40% of the free world's 40% of the free world's oil passage. Oil would quadruple. You'd have $300 a barrel oil if you could get it. The economies of the world would just literally fall like the Twin Towers did on 9/11. Without oil and a flow of it, things will come to a grinding halt. Now remember, two-thirds of our economy are wants. Only one-third of our economy here are needs, things you have to have, food, shelter. As less and less energy, water, food is available, the remaining energy and water are going to have to be replaced on that, supplying everyone with that one-third. We could have economic Armageddon, for the lack of a better word. We could lose two-thirds of our economy in a very, very short period of time. And that's not stretching the truth at all.
And, of course, I share your concern, David. I don't think the average individual out there believes it could happen. It couldn't happen here. Well, because I'm old enough to remember Germany after the Second World War. And I'm sure the German people, when, of course, their men were marching off to battle, you know, because they were going to go to war with the Russians, they were going to go to war with the French, they never thought that it could be their homes that would be destroyed. But I saw the rubble, and I remember standing in Mainz, once one of the great cities there on the Rhine River, and as far as you could see, nothing but rubble. Same thing with Cologne. The other thing still standing was the church in the middle of the city, and the rest of the city itself was rubble. People do not understand that war is a terrible thing. And our leaders here in the United States are intent upon plunging the United States into a war with Iran, which is totally irrational. But even more irrational is the fact that the leaders of Iran are doing everything they can to encourage that attack. This is where the insanity comes in. So when we're in a situation of this sort, people really should begin seriously contemplating what David is saying. Certainly, if you were to cut off the oil there, and of course they could certainly, with the missiles, really people have to understand that Iran is a client state of Russia. Russia is really behind this whole thing. Russia has been, of course, working with Iran, encouraged them at every step. They've given them sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles. They've given them sophisticated anti-tank missiles. They've given them sophisticated anti-ship missiles so that they can actually be capable with, even though they don't have any major ships of any size, they've got a lot, large numbers of very small ships equipped with sophisticated weapons that can take out our aircraft carriers.
Dr. Stan, here's a scenario. A couple large super tankers that are just basically sitting ducks, all right, full of oil, sunk in the Strait of Hormuz, soil the water, they foul the water. Ships can't pass through that heavy oil without fouling their hulls, and Lloyd's of London won't insure it. You can't take your ship through there. It's too dangerous. It just shuts down, and we didn't have to sink anybody's military ship, just a couple of super tankers.
And, of course, all they would have to do would be, of course, use their missiles to actually take out the loading docks there in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And, of course, that would simply cut off the oil. Because Japan is totally dependent upon Iranian oil. They wouldn't be getting Iranian oil. They wouldn't be able to buy Saudi oil or Kuwaiti oil. And we're really talking, could be a few weeks or a few months away from a financial Armageddon. And not only with that, of course, would come the real problems as far as food distribution. And the average American is totally unaware of this. So I share your concern, Herman. I think we're in very, very real trouble. And I think maybe the leaders of the Mormon Church, even though we may disagree with them theologically, at least they're warning people to begin making preparations.
In support of what Herman said, yes, we have noticed there are publications out that the church is putting a large push on getting prepared. They sense something is really wrong.
Are you getting anything from the Mormon Church?
Yes, I am.
All right, fine. Anything else, Herman?
Well, I just, as you were commenting, Dr. Stan, I remind people to go back and review the history of Nazi Germany. Hitler was a madman. In retrospect, but he was tapping into occult forces, and he basically plunged the world into world war.
And exactly, and as Ahmadinejad, I believe, is, of course, tapping into occult forces.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is a number of observers have mentioned that Iran's plan is to use what they call asymmetrical warfare. In other words, if we attack in a conventional way Iran, they will not attack us in a conventional way. They will use an unconventional way, which could be planting bombs or using terrorists in this country. And today's event, or yesterday's in Virginia, proved how vulnerable we really are. Now, that was only killing 33 people, including the man that did it. Every day in Baghdad, more than that are blown up. What if those types of things begin to happen in this country, if our infrastructure is targeted, et cetera?
I share your concern. I really do. Anything else, Herman?
No, that's it.
God
thanks
bless.
For the
thanks
program.
For, thanks very much.
And to ask our readers or listeners to share this with their friends.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. And of course, our guest this evening is David Sibley, and we're talking certainly about the very real problem that we may very well have here in the not-too-distant future of either food shortages or difficulty getting food distributed. And, of course, if the price of diesel were to go up, it would make it increasingly difficult to get your deliveries, get things delivered. You're not having any problem at the present time, though. Certainly deliveries are coming through on a regular basis, aren't they, Herman?
Not for those reasons. Not for the want of fuel or the cost. I'll give you a case in point. At the moment, we're having trouble finding apples.
Why are you having trouble finding apples?
I guess the apple crop last year wasn't all that plentiful.
All right.
That's what I'm being told. Okay, we can live without apples. In Georgia, for instance, some areas expect a 90% loss of the peach crop. Well, no apples, no peaches. Yeah, we can get by with that. Now we've got this latest freeze.
Do you have the peaches, though?
Oh, we have peaches. Oh. I'm just saying is the conditions that exist at the moment, we could be out of peaches. We could be out of apples. We could be out of, say, blueberries or blackberries.
Do you have blueberries and blackberries and things like that?
No, we do. We have done them in the past, and if there's a demand for them, we can do them when they're available. The point I'm making is this latest freeze we had in the Carolinas and Kentucky and stuff has decimated those crops for this year.
I see.
And a little bit here, a little bit here, a little loss here, a major loss here, no bees, no almonds. Before long, the shelves begin to get kind of bare, or prices go through the roof.
Okay, well, let's go to Jason, who's calling us from Maryland. Hi, Jason. How are you doing?
Fine, Dr. Stan. Thank you for taking my call. I believe that this is related in a roundabout way. I was trying to tell my aunt last night about the, I thought it was the Kyoto treaty or protocol that Clinton had signed, but I found out I was mistaken. What was the treaty that Clinton had signed?
I think he did sign the Kyoto Protocol. It was just never verified by our government, by our legislature.
Well, was that the one that called for the reduction in human population?
No, it called for a cutting back of the carbon emissions, so that where they were in 1990. So as I remember, of course, and correct me if anybody out there can remember, but I believe that Clinton signed this, but when they presented it to the Senate, they said, no way, Bill. And so that was the end of it, because it has to be ratified. He can sign the treaty, but it has to be ratified by the Senate. So the Senate even refused to consider that. But it called for a dramatic, of course, the first step of cutting back our carbon emissions to the level they were in 1990. What they really want, of course, is the protocol will limit America's carbon emissions by 80%. Now, it won't limit the carbon emissions of China or of India. The Kyoto Protocol is really an attack on the infrastructure of the United States to make America a third world nation. That's what it's all about, this whole thing on global warming is a scam. And, of course, if you'd like, we can get into this in much more detail some evening. I'm preparing a talk for it, and I don't think not one person in 100 knows how much carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere.
I think that what I was actually looking for, I'm sorry, Dr. Stan, but I know that Clinton signed some treaty that called for a human population reduction.
There is no treaty that, to my knowledge, that calls for population reduction. I mean, there's a plan for it, but there's no treaty that calls for it. He did, of course, in 1974, the government issued a National Security Study Memorandum 200, which, of course, calls for worldwide population control and SM is available through Radio Liberty. You can order that, or you can get it off the Internet. But to my knowledge, and I could be mistaken, but I don't think there's any treaty. They've never passed a treaty. They're doing it. They have a plan to massively decrease the world's population. But, of course, they've never wanted the people to know that the basis of American foreign policy is genocide.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Good night. God bless. Well, David, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Oh, thank you. Storing food will give you a nice, warm feeling. You go to bed at night knowing that you can ride out just about any, shall we say, quote, storm, unquote. Should we have a major terrorist attack, bird flu gets loose, you can feed your family, and you can, it gives you a lot of confidence, knowing that you're prepared, at least for that end. And that's one of those things that life goes on. If something bad happens, you have to have food, water, and shelter. That's all there is to it. Well, you can start. Most people have shelter. They live in a home. You can store water. There's ways to store water. Store the food, and you should be in top shape to survive any of the things we've discussed here this evening.
All right. I think it's important that people begin making the preparations and begin thinking about it. And don't put it off indefinitely. We've sent out, oh, I'd say hundreds and hundreds of copies of David's catalog. And I think David's had the same frustration that lots of people have the catalog, but they never get around to making those preparations. But I have a sense and a feeling of a sense of urgency, and I know David does as well because we've talked many times off the air. I mean,
well, I'm telling you that I like to tell people that if you're waiting for Katie Couric to tell you to do it, you're too late. So do it now while supplies are available. You do it quietly, very controlled. So when the herd spooks, when everybody finally figures out there's a problem, there's not enough resources to go around. You need to be prepared early. That's why they call it preparedness.
And, of course, the thing is that basically Maria Shriver here in California, the governor's wife, has actually been on television many times telling people, begin making preparations for disaster. Why would she do that night after night after night after night after night on television? Now, because the pre-recorded, it's the same ad, but I've seen at least 20 times this plea, begin making your preparations for disaster. What does Maria Shriver and Arnold know that the rest of us don't know? And, of course, it's always presented in a very benign manner, but I believe we should have a sense of urgency, especially when you contemplate that we're dealing with the very, very real possibility of being involved with a Russian proxy, which is Iran, in the very, very near future. And I'm sure Russia would just love to fight to the last American soldier in the Middle East. David, thank you so very much. Well, this is Dr. Stan. David Sibley, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Good night, Doctor.
Good night. And okay, fine. And for our listeners out there, of course, I hope that many of you will take seriously what David was saying and certainly my concern over this. If you would like information, we actually have a book called Making the Best of Basics. We have another book called Don't Get Caught with Your Pantry Down. And if you want, if we could supply that as well. Then, of course, if you would be interested in a catalog, we'd be glad to send you one. And it goes into, of course, what sort of things you would want to think about. You certainly want to think about water. You want to think about how to have water filters, and the Berkey products certainly allow you to be able to use water out of a stream or out of a creek or even out of a puddle and to be able to clean that up and utilize it. But certainly you want to have food available. You want to have water available. You want to be able to be warm. And most people are going to have to, whatever happens, going to have to stay in their homes. Now, we do have a great talk I've given. It's called Desperate Deception. It's a talk I gave back in 1992, and it simply goes into how the 911 issue was used to justify the passing of a series of draconian laws aimed at taking away our freedom. Desperate Deception, I think, is very well presented. It explains to you exactly what happened before 911 and what happened after 911. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set called the Military Commission Act. It's the Military Commission Act, which, of course, gives you the background of this legislation that was passed. If you'd like to know about the concentration camps, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are concentration camps. There really is a plan, in case of a national emergency, to round up American citizens and put them into camps. And if you doubt that, you'll want to get the concentration camp special or the amazing clips. There's a four-tape set on concentration camps. There is, of course, a DVD or a video, America Behind Barbed Wire. And then, of course, the amazing clips is certainly one of my, it's almost 3 hours, 3.5 hours, or 4 hours of some of the most surprising clips. But some of those deal with the plan to round up American citizens and put them in the camps. And you'll actually hear the congressman talking about this. You'll hear the Iran-Contra hearings when Congressman Jack Brooks tries to bring this out. The information is available from Radio Liberty. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you're interested in more information. Certainly, there is something called the Concentration Camp Special. People find this so difficult to believe, but it's not when you understand the secret. And this is why we have a talk called Forbidden Secret. We think it's quite good. It is a sequel to my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't seen the Brotherhood of Darkness, it is available on the Internet, free of charge. Just Google in Brotherhood of Darkness, Radio Liberty, and you can watch it if you'd like to. Of course, have it available for if you can show to others. Why, of course, you can always contact Radio Liberty. It is available in video or on DVD. But Forbidden Secret will tell you the secret that has been passed down for 5,000 years. And, of course, it was so secret that everybody was afraid to say it publicly. But it's there. And, of course, if you want to hear somebody talking about how this secret was kept and people would never talk about it, that's covered in Riddles and Stone, where one of the world's leading Masons makes the reference a number of times. The things we're talking about couldn't have been said 30 or 40 years ago. And why couldn't they have been said 30 or 40 years ago? Because, of course, they begin to take you into the secret. Riddles and Stone is certainly takes you into the secret architecture of our nation's capital and why we are fighting in the Middle East today and where this is going to head. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.